Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing program to our world-renowned theologians, we want our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
We live in such an addicted world. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. Alcohol addiction, we've been thinking about this Schedule II opiate carnage that, I mean, has claimed so many. I mean, look at the death of Prince on fentanyl. I just saw Gary Shandling had a Schedule II narcotic in his body when he died, the comedian. Here's Dr. John Spode, the director of the Center for Research, Doctoral Studies, and the Assistant Professor of Education. You presented twice at the Texas Counseling Association on the ethics of spiritual issues in addiction counseling.
That's correct.
Let's talk about it.
Okay, I would love to. I guess a little bit about my background would probably be helpful.
Yeah.
I'm a licensed professional counselor supervisor, and I'm a licensed chemical dependency counselor, and I have other licenses, but those two licenses in particular have allowed me to work with this population for a long time. And over the years, I've seen that there is a pull in the counseling world and a divide whether we should include spirituality and religion in our counseling methods and techniques and in the sessions that we provide to clients. And so I really felt like this was a good intro to be part of a discussion that needed to happen about how we can ethically include spiritual issues in counseling. And addiction is a great place to do it, because if you're familiar with the 12 steps, they include the acceptance of a higher power. And for many of those in the Christian faith, that includes Jesus Christ. And even it's gotten to the point where we have groups that are like Celebrate Recovery, and they've taken the 12 steps and put it into a very Christian format, and they've seen some pretty good success.
So, John, what did you say? I mean, HBU is proud to have you on our team, but to be so articulate in what I think is probably one of the pressing, crucial needs of our day. I mean, I don't know of any family that doesn't have an extended, if not immediate, family member who's not addicted.
Yeah,
I've been through this. My mother was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a Grand Canyon addiction that probably multi-generational that ran through our family. So what did you tell them?
So given where the field is at, we reviewed some of the important things related to trends that are happening on the national stage. And there's the American Counseling Association, ACA, and they've really tried to be vocal about taking a little bit of freedom away, I think, when it comes to including spirituality and religion.
ACA has?
And
why?
So I think that they are worried that people will use their faith to discriminate against people that are unlike them. So there's a push in the field right now where there are Christian counselors that don't understand or spend a lot of time understanding issues that are like the LGBTQ community or things like that. And so I think that there's this dichotomy. And so I felt like it's very important for Christians to have a voice as they're developing these standards. And ACA developed a set of standards. It's called a CERVIC. And I couldn't tell you the exact words for what it means, but it's A-S-E-R-V-I-C. And it goes through and outlines different things that you should be aware of when working with someone and including spiritual issues. And so mostly I wanted to, one, include counselors in the dialogue, especially in Texas. We have a pretty strong Christian population of counselors, and to let them know that there are standards forming on the national level and we need to be part of that conversation. And then two, that these things exist. And if you're going to incorporate things like spirituality and religion, you have to be aware of what the national ethics say. And so we also applied an ethical decision-making model where you go through and decide how to ethically behave as a counselor in the best interest of your client.
Okay, so help me with ACA. Give me its history and, You know, when I hear the word Christian, I think it's an operative in the association, but
ACA is the American Counseling Association.
Okay. And so is there any predisposition to the Christian faith in that group?
So what I found is that there's been kind of a divide.
Yep.
And so we have ACA, which is kind of the more secular counselor route, and then we have the AACC, which is the American Association of Christian Counselors, and they've kind of split into two tracks. But a lot of legislators and a lot of people that are deciding the trend for ethical behavior for licensed professional counselors, because it's a secular license given by the state, are tending towards ACA standards, and Christians have removed themselves to some extent. And so it's a much bigger issue, I think, than
And so what's your analysis of that bifurcation of Christians and ACA and AACC? I work with the American Association of Christian Counselors and their suicide outreach.
Yeah.
So what's your analysis of it?
I think that there is a lot of value in AACC. And I think it's given a voice and a place for us to develop ourselves as Christian counselors, being distinctly Christian and being able to include components of our faith and treatment of people. Because when you're able to touch them on a spiritual level, we can see some really powerful change, much differently than on a secular humanistic level. But as far as the secular side of things, I think that a lot of the discussion that's happening is very much in protecting clients' rights, but that leaves out the therapist a little bit and what they feel comfortable working with.
So clients' rights, so that would it be a violation to the client to bring in a spiritual or biblical perspective?
So the way that I do it in my private practice is in the intake paperwork, I ask questions about their spiritual life, their faith life, and if they want those components incorporated in the therapy that they receive. And so it's a discussion that should be had by all therapists, I think, with their clients, but I'm not sure that all therapists feel comfortable. Either they're not aware of where they stand spiritually, or it's an uncomfortable thing because people are all over the place and their beliefs and how they affect them. And so I am upfront about it in my practice, and I try to incorporate it in the intake on the very beginning and let them know this is an option of what we could include and what we cover in therapy.
Now, the largest Christian university in America says that about 35% of their enrollees are in some form of counseling major.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge intake.
Yeah.
Why is it so big?
I think we're in a fallen world, and I think there's a lot of people that are hurt by a lot of things that they experience in the fallen world. And we're not always equipped to deal with the tragedies that we see or the experiences that we have. I think almost every person in their life can point back to some traumatic event. I'm on a thesis committee right now, and one of my students is measuring trauma and how religious well-being offsets traumatic experiences. And in their research, when they're collecting data, of all the people they surveyed, 100, 120, I can't remember the number, but only one person said, I don't really have a traumatic event that I've ever had. And the median age of that study was students that were 22 years old. And so I think just given the nature of the traumatic events we've had on a societal level, on an individual level, there's just an increase for people wanting to help hurt people. And the most direct path to that is counseling. Because if you know about mental health professions, there's a wide range of mental health professionals, social workers, counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, and counselors are kind of the master's level therapists, and so are social workers. But it's kind of the most direct route to getting into the helping profession.
So students could come to HBU and they could pursue what kind of degrees through the offering here?
So we have the Master's of Arts in Counseling. And that's a pretty traditional program that prepares them for the LPC.
LPC.
Which is Licensed Professional Counselor.
Okay.
And that's through the state of Texas. And so we prepare them for it. And then after they graduate, they go and take a test, the NCE. and then they are able to apply to be an LPC intern.
Okay, NCE.
It is, I don't know the
National something.
Yeah, exam.
Right.
National Counseling Exam.
Yeah.
We'll take a stab. And then they, after they pass the test, they're able to apply to be a licensed professional counseling intern under the supervision of an LPC supervisor.
And translating that degree into a job, they could become a social worker?
What? Well, so social worker is a different branch. And I want to answer another part of the question first. We also have the MACC, which is the Master's of Arts in Christian Counseling, which also leads to an LPC if they apply for it after graduation. So we have two tracks that really help our students. And in the Master's of Arts in Christian Counseling, there's some Christian integration classes that are included. And so it includes a little bit more of the pieces related to Christian counseling. And then as far as career tracks, it's a long path to be an LPC. They finish their master's degree, and after their master's degree, they have to do 3,000 hours of supervised counseling as an intern before they become fully licensed. And so it's not a direct immediate path. They get their master's degree and they get to be a therapist, but they go through kind of this training process post-graduate work to become fully licensed. And so they can be a therapist. Some of our students work in private practice. Some of our students work in hospital settings. Some of them work in the schools. They'll get a dual certification, or they'll get their Master's of Education in School Counseling, and then also complete the coursework for their LPC. And so they get to do both types of counseling. Some will work for like foster care or adoption agencies. Some work in churches. So it just kind of depends on...
There's a lot of jobs in that area, isn't there?
There are. And I think it's one of the things I encourage all of my students is over the course of their studies and their licensure to develop specialties. Because I know I found a lot of my first jobs and connected with... I worked in an RTC. I worked at the another counseling center, and I've done things. And a lot of them were interested in some specialty that I had, whether it was being bilingual or being a LCDC, where I work with chemical dependency, or I'm also an NCC, which is a national credentialed counselor and a credentialed mediator. And so different places picked up on different specialties that they liked. And so we give them the foundation to get licensed, and then we encourage them to develop specialties in the areas they're passionate about.
How did you get attracted to Houston Baptist University?
Well, I was attracted to Houston Baptist University. I went to Baylor for my undergraduate, and right out of college, I worked at a church, and my pastor was actually on the HBU board at the time, Dr. Charles Wisdom. And so he, just from conversations that we had, and back then, Dr. Hodo was president, and we went on a mission trip to Venezuela together, and so it's always been something that I've been pretty passionate about, and being pretty strong in Baptist heritage. I don't know if it's on your paper, but I'm a pastor at a small country church out in Pattison, Texas.
Pattison.
And so it's just a small country church with less than 50 people, cow fields on all sides. But I've taken my Baptist heritage very seriously over the years, and I think there's a lot of really good things that we do as Baptists. And
has the APA become un-Christian or anti-Christian? American Psychological Association?
So,
Or would that be a broad overreach?
I think that's an overreach. I know that I'm involved with several committees on the state level for the Texas Counseling Association, and there are a lot of people who are very inclusive of people who come from a strong Christian background. But as I said before, I think it's important for us to step up and be part of the dialogue as opposed to pulling ourselves out. And so that being a light and being salt, you know, if we're only around salt, we're not really that salty, so we need to go out. So,
how does Jesus Christ come into the counseling environment?
I think in a lot of ways. I was teaching a class last night, and with my students, we were talking about ethics. It was an ethics class for school counselors. And I said that a lot of the truths that are seminal or important to the core of our faith are truths that apply across all kinds of settings. And so I think when we know what the Word of God says and we live out what the Word of God says and we have the Word of God written on our hearts, it can't help but come out in the conversations that we have, even if we're not blatantly saying, and in the book of John, in this chapter, in this verse, it says this, it comes out in a lot of ways. And as counselors, we're supposed to allow our clients to have the dialogue and incorporate them into the therapy process. And as I said, with the intake form, I try to be aware and cognizant of where they are and what they want included and not. But what's funny is over the course of therapy, many of the people who say no, they don't want it included at first, after they get into therapy and they spend some time getting to know me as a therapist and the values that I hold and the importance that my family has, they change their answer on the intake form and say, well, we could pray together. Or, yes, you can tell me a Bible verse if there's something you read that was cool. And so I think that it's being authentic and genuine. And I'm a really big fan of what Paul says about being called ministers of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And we're really called to bring a lost and hurt and dying world back to Jesus Christ. And I'm really impressed with the two great commandments to love God and love others. And I've always said in my life that when I don't know what to do, I use love as my true north, and I try to err on the side of love if I don't know how to respond. And so it's worked really well, I think, in being able to reach into people's lives and share truth with them.
Awesome. We're talking to John Spode, who's the director of the Center for Research and Doctoral Studies, assistant professor of education here at HBU. You know, I want to talk to you about chemical dependency.
Yeah.
And much of what I've read is that the United States is unique, a unique nation, and mm-hmm. that pharmaceuticals, I mean, there's no nation on planet Earth that compares to the consumption of prescription medicine mm-hmm. that the United States does.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Schedule II narcotics weren't even regulated by the FDA. Mm-hmm. I was in Washington doing a documentary on it and walking with Senator Schumer, and I was mm-hmm. with a bunch of parents that were mm-hmm. holding placards of their children mm-hmm. in color pictures, all dead, all mm-hmm. that had, you know, gotten on Schedule II narcotics. Yeah. FDA, so there's the drug companies mm-hmm. have two lobbyists on every congressman.
At least, yeah.
Pharma's a big deal here. Mm-hmm. I mean, translate this problem to the average person today. I later in San Diego actually went undercover with mm-hmm. the DA that was busting doctors that were, you know, abusing the pharmaceutical pad. Mm-hmm. Is it a big problem?
Yeah, absolutely it is.
How
I think
proportionately to this nation compared to others?
So when I first got into counseling a decade or more ago, having the LCDC, at first I was referred all of the people that were dealing with addiction. And then very quickly it became apparent that almost every client that comes in has some form of addiction in a family member or in the workplace or in something. And I think it's very interesting in this last round of an interesting fact, addiction isn't actually a diagnosis in the DSM-5. It's about abuse and use and dependence.
And let's define that DSM-5.
DSM-5, the diagnostic manual that we use for making diagnoses related to mental health issues.
Yeah, I flipped through that book. It's quite interesting.
It's a big book. And so for the first time in this last revision that they just released a few years back, they included addiction gambling could be part of that subset of things that people get addicted to. And so I think we're just gonna see the term addiction increase in our society over time now that they've opened the door for addiction to be more than just substances. I mean, substances are huge and they are everywhere, and we see a lot of, there's a training that I like to go to, and it's current drug trends, because the drug trends are always changing. And it's amazing how the youth are so innovative when it comes to being able to influence the way that they are experiencing the world by incorporating some kind of drug or addiction. And so it's almost impossible to keep up with because it's constantly changing and growing. And so it takes a lot of effort.
You know, the whole issue on the building the wall and all that kind of mm-hmm. issue is the cartels are now in the major cities of America because of Schedule II narcotics.
Right.
eventually you can't get a script, so mm-hmm. you reduce yourself to mm-hmm. buying heroin on the streets.
Yeah.
And we're talking about mega thousands of people mm-hmm. and probably a bunch of them that are sitting in Baptist churches yeah. in the state of Texas, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, take the veneer off this, that Christian people,
yeah.
many of them, suffer from addiction.
They do. One of my favorite people in the world, his name is James May, and he passed a few years back, but he was a recovering alcoholic, and he did AA in our church. And it was simply amazing how much response from the community we got by just doing something as simple as hosting AA meetings on Thursdays and Sundays, and how strongly connected they felt with the church, even though it wasn't necessarily a church function. We just allowed them to use the buildings to perform the AA meetings. But we saw a lot of residual effect in family members coming and in people in the community feeling more connected with the church, because we weren't pretending like there wasn't a problem, but we were addressing the problem head on. And James May was just integral to all of that, because he knew what it was, and he, part of his healing process was becoming a Christian and accepting Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. And he just touched so very many lives. So.
John, I mean, why your personal interest in this field? I mean, I have an interest in suicide because I almost killed myself mm-hmm. as a teenager. And mm-hmm. so it's been a lifelong preoccupation. Why
yeah.
you?
I think that...
You ever been an addict?
I have not been an addict. I'm a Baptist, and so I...
But those aren't oxymorons,
I know, those aren't oxymorons. But I have not been addicted to anything and have never really used substances. Really...
How about Krispy Kreme donuts? Anything?
Krispy Kreme donuts, absolutely. No, but I think that it started when I was a youth pastor, and I realized that I really honed in on individual kids
yep.
as opposed to... You know, being in front, this is very anti my normal setting. Usually I'm behind closed doors speaking to people. And I had one youth, and I remember it was a youth retreat. And basically the choice was, if he went on the youth retreat, he wouldn't get jumped into a gang. But if he stayed home, his family and his parents and his aunts and uncles and everything were in the gang. And this was the weekend he was going to get jumped in. And I worked with him and prayed with him and did all these things. And then he didn't come to the retreat. And I held the buses, I drove to his house to try to find him, but I lost him.
Yeah.
And not just lost him from the church, but lost him, like he disappeared for several months and resurfaced later in a very bad state. And a lot of it had to do with addiction and drugs. And I really understood much more powerfully just how much that one decision can really set someone on a path that maybe they didn't want to be on. Because years later, as an adult, he came back and we had lots of conversations about it and shared his regrets and where he wanted to be.
How old are your children?
4, 6, and 11.
Okay, and any fear about the world there?
Absolutely. One of the prayers my wife prays for them constantly is that they wouldn't fall into addiction, because there's just some part of you that responds almost instinctually to the drug or whatever you're addicted to. And it can make you do things that you wouldn't do if you were thinking through things to the best of your ability as a teenager.
Let me ask you this. If you had an addiction yeah. going through HBU with this specialty, mm-hmm. I mean, would it be therapeutic? I mean, not only matriculate to get a degree, but are people that have had an addiction drawn to this area?
Absolutely. I was one of the few with an LCDC that hasn't been addicted myself. And so it's an issue sometimes. People think, well, you don't understand addiction if you haven't been addicted yourself. But there's a lot of people who have gone through the process of the 12 steps or Celebrate Recovery or some kind of healing process and then devote their life to trying to help people understand and respond differently to addiction.
And, you know, we say that the abused abuse mm-hmm. in domestic abuse.
Yeah.
Is addiction multi-generational? Are you more predisposed to addiction?
Absolutely. There's a predisposition I think the statistic is if you have addiction in your family tree, and it doesn't even have to be direct, like aunts and uncles, right. I think there's a like 5 to 8 times more likely that you'll deal with some kind of addiction yourself.
What do you do when you read the story of like Prince, you know, mm-hmm. who's a musical genius,
yeah.
no question about it. And he's taking fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the milligram level is yeah. off the charts.
Right.
And this guy's doing concerts,
yeah.
which speaks of long-term addiction. I remember reading Michael Jackson could take 20 sleeping pills and stay up and
yeah.
ended up on Propofol,
yeah.
you know, with Conrad Murray on the phone with whoever while he unfortunately dies. I mean, the system can acclimate only so long and then extinction comes.
Yes, absolutely.
But are you psychologically immune on the journey of addiction about your safety?
I think that, to use an old wives' tale, I guess, it's like the frog in the boiling pot of water. When you turn it up 1 degree at a time, the frog doesn't jump out of the pot, and then before you know it, it's sitting in boiling water. I think that's kind of similar to what happens in addiction. You don't even realize how far you've gotten, and it's easy to get in over your head very quickly and very easily. And the thing about addiction is it's different for every person. And so some people, from the first time they use, they have some addictive tendency. Mm-hmm. And for other people, it takes years, and then they become addicted to whatever substance it is. And so I think that complicates the field too, because it's not it's not like appendicitis. Your appendix is about to burst, we're going to take it out, and it's very standardized. It's very unique and different for every person, and so that complicates it.
Now, is there a pain component to addiction in the emotional pain?
Yeah, there is some literature, even about physical pain, that people self-medicate to dull the senses or to dull the physical pain they're in. And there's a pain clinic in town. And what's ironic is that a large portion of pain is psychological in nature. And so even with medication, there are some pain victims who still suffer from pain because there's only so much that medicine can do. And they're actually finding that there's a lot more to do with the psychological components.
And then let's just wrap up here on alcohol addiction.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's socially acceptable to drink. Many people do.
Yeah.
My wife's
an attorney. I know all too well.
And, you know, I rarely meet an alcoholic who'll admit they're an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was an alcoholic. She was averaging a quart of vodka a day and working all day long.
Yeah.
Thank God was delivered from that. But, I mean, how precarious is this alcohol thing in the United States?
I think it's something that's complicated in a lot of ways because it is a legal drug.
Right.
And so because
but it is a drug.
It is.
C2860, I think they call it.
Good chemistry, yeah. And so it does fall in the DSM under things that you can experience use, abuse, and those dependence upon. And so are cigarettes and e-cigs and all those things. They have addictive components to them. But then if we're being honest, there's addictive components to electronics and to refined sugar and to...
Look at the iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm addicted to the thing every 10 minutes.
I won't admit my addiction on air, but yes, I know.
And what about, is workaholism addiction? My kids say I've got that addiction. Is that true?
Well, so it's not in the DSM.
Oh,
so
good.
It wouldn't be an official diagnosis that
so
I could make.
So I can refute that.
Yes.
But
I think that there is something to, as I said before, that they've expanded it. And for the first time, they included something that was not a substance, like gambling. And so I think that opens the door for the addiction community at large to have this conversation about what are the defining characteristics of addiction? What does it look like? And can you be addicted to things besides things that you ingest or take into your body? So
both in the undergraduate and in the postgraduate, there's lots of academic offering?
Yeah, and we actually, part of the state of Texas, the licensure for LPC, starting in fall 2017, the requirement to become an LPC is shifting from 48 to 60 hours. Mm. And so part of the 60 hours is going to be an addiction class. So.
And there is a danger to getting counseling from someone who's not really has the credential.
Absolutely. I think that there are the whole point of having the credential, the whole point of having ethical standards at the state and national level is that we are treating clients kind of in a uniform way to give them the best care possible. And I think the other thing about counseling is it's really a field that's in its infancy. If you look at counseling as a whole, it's been incorporated in a lot of different aspects like preachers and confidants and things over the years. But as far as being its own field that's separate and been pulled apart, it's only been in the last 100 years that we've really started to develop it. And so it's not like being a doctor that's been around for thousands of years and has developed over that period of time. We're really at the beginning. And so it's very exciting to be a counselor. And I think there's a lot that we can have in this time right now to create a voice for what's going to happen for years to come in this profession.
We've been talking to Dr. John Spode, Director of the Center for Research, Doctoral Studies, and the Assistant Professor of Education, Houston Baptist University. You can learn more at hbu.edu. Dr. Spode, we are really honored to have you a part of the team here at HBU.
Thank you.
You're right on the number of what's happening, you and all your colleagues, and can't say enough about how important this particular area of academia is at HBU, and lots of opportunity. Tell everybody you know to check it out at HBU, Dr. Edu, and of course Dr. John Spode can answer questions further. Thank you.
At HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.